certain, it's important. It makes us do things differently. It's like being in another country. Now, I don't know what the words another country bring to your mind. Maybe something exotic, you know, sun and sand and all that kind of thing. Maybe something a bit frightening, strange. They do things differently there. Something disturbing. Maybe the words just mean home. And we're going to look at what these words meant to Abraham. There's a whole chapter full of examples. We shall not, unfortunately, have time to look at them all. We'll just stick with Abraham and one other. And for Abraham, this country, this strange country, was a promised land. Now, the promise seems to have first come to Abraham when he was in a place called Ur of the Chaldees, a big city, an important city. He was doing all right there. Nicely settled, big family, rich. It was not a place you would necessarily wish to leave unless you were going to something better. He must have known something about God. We don't know exactly what he knew, but he knew enough to be convinced when God spoke to him and said, "Get out. I'm not going to tell you where, just I've got somewhere for you. Another land, a promised land." Well, that's curious enough in itself. I mean, we don't usually set off not knowing where we're going to get to, do we? We may not get to where we intended to, but that's another matter. And another curious thing about it was that God said, "And this land that I'm taking you to, it's going to be for you and it's going to be for your descendants forever." And Abraham had no descendants, no children. So all in all, a bit strange. But he set off. He got to a place called Haran, and that's where he stopped for a bit. The whole family settled down. You read a bit of the story about Abraham in Genesis. You read another bit in Acts where Stephen is talking about him. You put the two together and smooth the edges a little bit, and you find that in Haran, Abraham and his father and his nephew and all their families seem to have stayed for quite a time, and there again they did very well in Haran. But his father didn't want to go on any further, so he stayed there, and eventually he died there. But it seems that God spoke to Abraham again, and he said, "Abraham, remember, you've been given this promise. It's time to get moving, time to go a bit further." It's a bit like us, really. Sometimes God sometimes needs to remind us of what he's said to us already. Was it 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, Doug Crisp was here, and he was talking about that very same thing, how he was called into the ministry, and it took time and reminders from God before he actually went ahead with it. Well, I don't know what the promised land is that God's calling us to. Might not be a different country at all. It might just be doing something different. Might be using gifts that he's given us and we're not using them, or we've used them in the past and then forgotten about it and things have settled down. But he's saying, "It's time now, time to be doing what I called you to." And Abraham obeys and sets off. And that's where it gets strange again. Seeing as I'm going to use the letter P for a promised land, I had to choose a rather complicated word for the next bit. I called it a paradoxical journey. Things weren't as they logically should be. Things were contradictory. And that's really because Abraham's journey isn't like the normal sort of journey that you get to go out on a quest to reach a goal. Now, the book I've been reading recently is very similar to most of them in that vein. It starts off with the hero, or heroine, or both, going off on this quest. And so you get all manner of disasters and adventures and problems befalling them. Just confronted by mountains and rivers and weather and wild animals and attacks from this group and betrayals from that group. And eventually, after about 400 pages, they got to the goal. And then they had to come back, and in 20 pages, they were home. It was all so straightforward once they'd reached the goal and achieved what there was for them there. Now, Abraham's journey wasn't like that at all. If you read the story in Genesis, in chapter 12, in verse 4, he leaves Haran. By verse 7, he's in the land and he's building an altar to God there. By verse 8, he's gone further in and he's building another. No problems. Nobody's causing him any difficulty. There were people already in the land, but everything seems to be fine. Lovely. Honeymoon period. Well, we've all had good times like that as a church or as a family, even ourselves. God says something, we move, God blesses. Lovely. No problem. And then Abraham left. There was a famine in the land, as there often were, and we don't read that God said stay or go, but Abraham decided to go into Egypt where there was more food, and it was quite normal. He was used to living a semi-nomadic life, you know, moving along with all the flocks and herds. So it was quite normal to move down to Egypt. Excuse me a minute. I don't know where these coughs have come from. We've all got one, haven't we? Thank you, yes. Right, where were we? He got down into Egypt and then he ran into trouble because he was concerned that Pharaoh, once he saw Abraham's wife Sarah, who was very beautiful, he was concerned that Pharaoh would want to take her and dispose of Abraham. So he concocted a story. It was just about true. You know, he said that Sarah was his sister, not his wife. Well, she was his half-sister. Okay, it's a different culture. They did things differently then. But it turns out that Pharaoh actually behaves a lot better than Pharaoh in the and than Abraham in these circumstances. Because when Pharaoh finds out what is happening, he says, "You should have told me. I'm going to give her back to you. No problem. You can go on your way with all that belongs to you." The next thing I've got written down, it says, "Try harder." It's disconcerting, isn't it, when we discover that God's people don't have a monopoly on good behaviour, and somebody that we didn't expect does something more in God's will than we do. We've tried very hard. It's like being apprenticed to a craft, you know, you've been learning from the experts, getting better and better, and then things go wrong. And then I realised that the Christian life, it's not a craft at all. It's an art. You see, when you're thinking of a craft, it's always the possibility, eventually, of achieving perfection, a masterpiece. But with art, there's never really a question of perfection. There's always the possibility of something better than the current situation. There's always more inspiration more that can be done. Never really satisfied, because there's always more. So that's a little bit of comfort. And Abraham, he comes back, having learnt quite a bit in Egypt, gets back into the land, and then his problems start. Battles, trouble with the neighbours, family problems. If you read Genesis, you'll find out about all of them. The battles with five kings, and we find out how important a man Abraham was at that stage, because he was able to put over 300 soldiers into the field. Trouble with the neighbours. Well, that had to come sooner or later, didn't it? And it does come. Family problems. He had this nephew, Lot. You've probably heard about Lot, who was more concerned about getting the best bit of the country. When Abraham said to him, well, do you want to go this way or that way? Lot chose the best bit. Abraham never really learnt that idea of sharing, did he? Where one person divides and then the other person chooses. Now, Abraham was too generous with Lot. And then Lot got into trouble in Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham had to rescue him. But one way or another, there are big victories, small victories, problems, just the sort of thing that we all experience in our Christian lives. And even the writer to the Hebrews, when he's praising Abraham for living by faith and doing what God has said, admits that he probably was tempted to go back to his previous home, to what he'd left. After all, he could have done. There was time for him to do it. He knew the way. Nobody was going to put obstacles in his way. He was the leader of the clan. He could very well have gone back if that had been his choice. And it must have been tempting. He'd done very well back in Ur. May very well have had relations still back there. He could have gone back. But he didn't. He didn't look back. Rather different from the children of Israel when they were on the way to the Promised Land after a rather longer stay in Egypt. Because they started to think about looking back. And what did they think about when they considered their time in Egypt? Now, you might have supposed, mightn't you, that they'd think about the bad times there. Think about the fact that they've been enslaved by Pharaoh. Think about the way they had to be building those bricks, not with London clay, but without even being given the necessary ingredients for them. They might have remembered the way that Pharaoh wanted to kill the baby boys to make sure that their population went down. You might have thought they would be terrified when they remembered the plagues that they'd seen back in Egypt. You might have thought they'd look back on all of these things and perhaps consider they were better off out of them. But when the children of Israel looked back to their time in Egypt, do you know what they thought of? It tells you in Numbers chapter 11. Cucumbers. Seriously? Cucumbers and melons and leeks and onions and garlic. That's what they thought about. They drove Moses to distraction. I'm not surprised. Well, what, spiritually speaking, do we each have as an equivalent of cucumbers? Probably different for each of us. But we can look back to before we really knew God, what our life was like then, and we pick on something that we really enjoyed. Your cucumbers or your melons or maybe even the garlic. And think of that and think, I miss that. I wouldn't mind going back to that. Or maybe again, if we've been Christians for a long time and it's difficult to remember what life, what the few years that there were of life before then were like, and we can think, well, if I hadn't become a Christian then, I could have been doing this and I could have had that and my life could have taken this turn. Or we start thinking about what might have been. Or we start looking back when God or his people start to become too demanding, when we can't see the way forward. Look back to what we left or what we might have had. And then this chapter in Hebrews calls our bluff. It says, if you really want to go back, what's stopping you? But do you really think it's worth it? Would you not rather be like Abraham, press on to this better country, this better thing that God has prepared for us? Because what is the better thing? Why do we want to leave the past? There's one author called L.P. Hartley who talks about the past, and he says, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. That's true enough. If we went back, things would not be as we knew them originally, and we should find ourselves out of place, because we've been used to something different. And by not going back, Abraham and people like him declared that he was looking for another country, a better one, a heavenly one, something that God had prepared for him. This bit from Hebrews talks about God preparing a city. Now, what exactly do we mean by that? Was the writer of Hebrews thinking about the earthly Jerusalem that was going to be made in Israel for the descendants of Abraham? Was that the heavenly city? In that it was God who had chosen it to be there? Could it possibly be the new Jerusalem that we read about in Revelation, coming down from heaven at the end of time? Could it be the kingdom of God that was revealed through Jesus and that we're told is not far away from any of us, and it's even in believers? Could this be the new city, the other country that God's got prepared? Could it be a totally heavenly country? Have we got to wait till we get to heaven to appreciate it? Well, I don't think so, because Christianity, the Christian life, what God has for us, applies to this life as well as what will follow it. So let's look at the key words in the reading. When we read about this city, this country that God has prepared, we read about things like foundations, that God is the architect and the builder. We read about a city that is permanent. In the Bible, God gives plans for two places. One of them was the tabernacle in the wilderness, when the children of Israel were travelling to their new country, and we got all of the plans for it. But that was a temporary structure. We get up to the time of King David, and God gives him God's Spirit gives him some details of the temple that Solomon is going to build. But there again, that didn't last forever. That temple was destroyed. So there's got to be something more that God plans as the architect, that God builds or enables us to build, that is permanent. Probably struck a real chord with Abraham, because remember, all the time he's been in this promised land, he's been living in tents. Okay, very elaborate tents, beautiful tents, but the whole thing about a tent is that it's got no foundations. It can just be folded up and moved on somewhere else. God is talking now about somewhere permanent, somewhere that has foundations. And he's got the same meaning for us, because I don't know whether Mike is ever going to sing that song, all about this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. Now would be a very appropriate time. No. But that's true. God's got something more permanent for us. In Colossians, Paul talks about continuing the faith, being grounded and settled. There again, talking about being permanently fixed in Christ. That's what faith means, being fixed, settled. And what's this faith based on? Because the writer of Hebrews got a lot to say about faith, but what's it all based on? Where does it come from? How can we rely on it? And what it says here is that Abraham judged him faithful who had promised. Now that's a bit presumptuous, really, isn't it? We judge God? What it means is that faith is not just a vague hope. It means that we've trusted God in small things. We've found that he's reliable. We've found that we can believe what he says. We've gone on further. We've experienced more. We've got to know what it's like to live believing in him, to live in faith. We've experienced more of him, and we find ourselves becoming more and more convinced that this is the sort of God we have, the one who can be trusted, the one who is reliable. That's what the judging is. It's not just a vague hope. It's experience. It's knowledge. It's something that's secure. It's something that can keep us trusting in him, even when the circumstances are difficult, because we know, we've found out what sort of a God we have. I think this is a good time to sing a final hymn, which is Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah, because it's talking about this same journey and talking about